All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. It's Thursday, October 13th, and some students are coming in to take a look at your tests. I recommend that everybody come in and take a look at their tests just to see how I word things and you just become a little bit more familiar with the exam figures and that kind of stuff, so it's really a good thing. All right, so on the screen I have the same slide. Looks different, but they should be the same slide. We were talking about autonomic nervous system, and last time we started talking about it. So how many divisions are there in the autonomic nervous system? There are two, and they're called sympathetic and parasympathetic. What's the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic in terms of function? They're antagonistic to each other. That's right. And a good example, the reason why for autonomic nervous system you have two is because, for instance, you only have one heart, right? As a matter of fact, I want to go back to something before then. All right, so as opposed to the autonomic nervous system, the motor autonomic nervous system, what's another nervous system that goes to voluntary organs as opposed to involuntary? It's called a somatic motor nervous system, okay? And that is not built on antagonism. But I suppose you wouldn't expect that, because what are the effector organs for the somatic nervous system? Skeletal muscle. And how is your body organized and designed? So that you have antagonistic muscles in opposite body compartments, right? So you have that inherent antagonism built into the musculoskeletal system. So you don't need it in the nervous system. But how many hearts do you have?
One.
You just have one. So therefore, you need nice antagonistic control. You need dual input. You need both parasympathetic and sympathetic input to the heart so that it can be controlled through antagonism, or through antagonistic mechanisms. And why is that a good thing? What does antagonism provide for an organ system? Precise control and balance. Okay, great. All right, so that's why there are two divisions of the autonomic nervous system. And we looked at some neurotransmitters last time. Let's see if I go back to this slide right here. Okay, what are the two major classes of neurotransmitters or neurons that secrete these neurotransmitters in the autonomic nervous system? They're cholinergic, right? Cholinergic neurons, if they secrete, what is a neurotransmitter? Acetylcholine. And what's the other major class? Adrenergic, if they secrete norepinephrine as a neurotransmitter. Okay, and in particular, the other thing that's noteworthy about this diagram right here, oh look, I have a nice mouse with a cursor. I did. Here it is. Let me turn it on, make sure it doesn't go away. Okay, so don't forget, for an autonomic outflow pathway, it takes two neurons, a pre-ganglionic and a post-ganglionic, with one exception. What's the exception to that rule? Okay, somatic is one, okay, but all autonomic pathways, except for one, require a pre-ganglionic and post-ganglionic fiber, right, with a ganglion in between, which in every case, regardless if it's a parasympathetic or sympathetic, right, it's going to use acetylcholine within the ganglion. But there is one exception to where you don't have a postganglionic fiber. And it is in the sympathetic nervous system, when a preganglionic sympathetic fiber goes to the adrenal medulla. The adrenal medulla is acting like the postganglionic fiber. It's not a neuron. It doesn't send action potentials anyplace. But when it depolarizes, it automatically releases epinephrine and norepinephrine into the blood, which then travels everywhere. So these chromaffin cells in the adrenal medulla are acting like quasi-postganglionic fibers. Even though they don't send electrical signals anywhere, they just automatically release norepinephrine and epinephrine. And since they're picked up by the blood, then we consider these compounds hormones. Okay, and not necessarily neurotransmitters in this particular case. But what about norepinephrine that I see right here, released from this postganglionic fiber? What would you consider norepinephrine in this particular case when it's released from this neuron? Okay, so this is what, an adrenergic neuron, and it's releasing norepinephrine. What would be the general name for norepinephrine in this particular case? Would you consider this a hormone? Okay, and you know what? I want to change your opinion on that. No, I would consider this a neurotransmitter because it's being released from this neuron. And it's going to bind to a receptor on a target tissue that's very close to this axon terminus. Okay, so norepinephrine in this particular case is acting like a neurotransmitter. Norepinephrine, when it's released from the adrenal medulla, since it gets picked up by the blood and transferred everywhere, then norepinephrine is acting like a hormone. Okay, so that's a nice interface we see between the nervous system and endocrine system. And in a lot of classes, maybe some more advanced classes, we don't just study the nervous system as one system by itself and the endocrine system a system by itself, but they interact in a number of locations of the body, and you really have to consider what the neuroendocrine system, because sometimes a particular chemical like norepinephrine can act like a hormone, and in other cases it acts or behaves like a neurotransmitter. All depends on the particular application. All right, then we talked about these synapses and passants, and in particular, the effect of smooth muscle right here. Smooth muscle can make up its own mind whether it's going to contract, right, because it gets dual innervation. And so it integrates the sympathetic activity with the parasympathetic activity and then can change its behavior, right, in graded fashions, as opposed to skeletal muscle. Does a skeletal muscle ever make up its own mind if it's going to contract or not? No, because when a skeletal muscle receives action potentials, it always depolarizes and contracts. All right, then this is, I think, one of the last slides that we looked at. In terms of adrenergic fibers, please know that there are two main subclasses, the alpha and beta subtypes right here, and this helps explain how one neurotransmitter, for instance, like norepinephrine, can have different effects in different tissues. And that's because different tissues can have different receptors. And some receptors are excitatory, okay, like for instance these alpha ones, and some receptor types are inhibitory, okay, like beta 2 right here in the lungs. That causes smooth muscle relaxation, causes dilation of airway, so makes it easier for somebody to breathe or ventilate. Okay, so one particular neurotransmitter can have different actions in the body because different parts of the body have different receptors. All right, so here is another really good exam figure. We see, we're going to contrast the parasympathetic nervous system with the sympathetic nervous system right here. And what about, how do you know that we don't have a diagram of the somatic motor nervous system right here? How would you analyze this slide to convince me that I don't have a somatic motor pathway right here? Because you see a preganglionic and postganglionic neuron, and for somatic motor, there's only one neuron. There's no preganglionic or postganglionic. There's just one neuron that goes from the central nervous system all the way to the effector organ, right? So in every case, I see a preganglionic and postganglionic fiber. So therefore, I know these are all autonomic pathways. All right, now what kind of synapses are we looking at right here at the junction between the preganglionic and postganglionic fiber? What kind of synapse? And remember, what is a synapse? Okay, synapse is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells, right? And there are two major ways that cells can communicate with each other, right? And which way is this right here? Yeah, this is a chemical synapse, because I actually see this chemical moving from the preganglionic cell down to the postganglionic cell right here. What's the other kind of synapse? Electrical, where cells actually contact each other and sodium can move from one cell into another cell via a gap junction, and it moves into a second cell, causes depolarization or excitation. But in this particular case, chemicals are used, and those chemicals released by one neuron, right, and then they'll bind to receptors in the postganglionic cell. That chemical is what we call a neurotransmitter. And you got to know some specific names of neurotransmitters. right? In every case, when it's the parasympathetic nervous system or the sympathetic nervous system right here, all the preganglionic fibers are what kind of fibers? Okay? It uses the same neurotransmitter here, same neurotransmitter here, same neurotransmitter here and here. So what can you tell me about all these preganglionic fibers? They're cholinergic because they use acetylcholine. The receptors in the postganglionic cells right here are all nicotinic types. So what can you tell me about acetylcholine? How does it work, right, within the ganglion? Can it be excitatory sometimes and inhibitory at other times? No, it can't. What is it going to be in every particular case, whether it's parasympathetic or sympathetic? It's going to be excitatory because nicotinic receptors, right, as soon as they bind to acetylcholine molecules, open up a sodium channel. So sodium rushes in the cell. What does that produce then on these neurons right here, these postganglionic fibers, when sodium enters? Okay, yeah, graded potentials, but what kind? IPSP or EPSP? Yeah, an excitatory postsynaptic potential, which is what? Excitatory, which then will always excite all of these cells. So inhibition never takes place within the ganglion. Okay, then we have the postganglionic fiber. And I see this one right here is releasing acetylcholine. And so what division of the autonomic nervous system has cholinergic postganglionic fibers? That's the parasympathetic division, right? And the effector organs that are innervated by the parasympathetic nervous system have muscarinic-type receptors. And muscarinic receptors sometimes are excitatory, sometimes they're inhibitory. All depends on the target tissue. And we're going to look at that in a little bit. Okay? And here are three particular examples of adrenergic receptors in effector organs. So we have viscera and skin. Right, so these are alpha-1 adrenergic receptors, and it is norepinephrine is going to be excitatory. These are all G-protein coupled receptors as well, working through second messenger systems. Right, but alpha-1 receptors typically are excitatory. It causes contraction of smooth muscle, so it causes vasoconstriction in most parts of the body, including the viscera and the skin. Because how would you think of the sympathetic nervous system? Does that make sense if you think of sympathetic nervous system? What does a sympathetic nervous system allow you to do? What kind of mood does it promote? What kind of state does it promote in the body? The fight or flight response, right? So you don't need to have blood going to digestive organs. You don't need to have blood going to skin. Where do you need to have blood going to? Muscles, your heart, and your brain to deal with that stressful circumstance, right? So that makes really nice, perfect sense. Okay, here are another outflow pathway, and this is going to end in beta-1 adrenergic receptors. And where do we find beta-1 adrenergic receptors? In the heart, because beta-1, and what does that match up with? How many hearts do you have? You just have one heart, right? And that is excitatory on the heart. Again, it's a G-protein coupled receptor. It will increase both the heart rate and the contractility of the heart. What did we call adjustments to heart rate? Chronotropy. What do we call adjustments to contractility of the heart? Inotropy, right? So it just so happens that sympathetic stimulation of the heart increases both heart rate and contractility of the heart. It will increase cardiac output. When we get to the cardiac chapter, you're going to have a lot of fun realizing and seeing how that all works together. All right, beta-2 receptors are found. Give me an example of where they're found. Lungs, okay. But in this particular case, norepinephrine is inhibitory. It works through a different G-protein coupled system, causes dilation, causes relaxation of smooth muscle of bronchioles so that they dilate, and that's a very powerful effect that increases airflow through these airways. All right, so this is a really good exam figure. Make sure you know everything on this figure right here. So drugs that promote the actions of a neurotransmitter are what we call agonists. And drugs that inhibit the actions of a neurotransmitter are called antagonists. And it just so happens that nicotine okay, is an agonist. It works on the autonomic nervous system at all ganglionic synapses. Okay, so how come nicotine isn't just a really powerful drug that automatically kills somebody, since it's adjusting your autonomic nervous system? It's controlling your heart rate, for instance. Because what can you tell me about antagonistic systems? What happens to your car if you just hit the accelerator? What happens to your car? It speeds up. What happens if you just hit the brake pedal the same amount, the same pressure? It's going to stop. Now, what happens if you hit the accelerator and the brake pedal at the same time with the same amount of force? What will they do? They'll cancel each other out. And that's what we mean by a balanced system. Okay, so when somebody takes nicotine into their body, it's not immediately fatal because it cancels out, because the autonomic nervous system is antagonistic to each other. As opposed to muscarin, right, this is a chemical found in mushrooms, is always fatal because it just affects, right, one division of the autonomic nervous system, namely the parasympathetic. It poisons the parasympathetic nervous system. Okay, so there is no antagonism at that level, like you see antagonism with these nicotinic receptors, right, at the ganglionic synapses. Okay, ask me again. Receptors. Well, you're asking the effect of something on a receptor?
Yes, muscarinic.
Oh, the muscarinic receptors?
Yeah.
Yeah, the poison, the muscarine that's in mushrooms, when you eat a poisonous mushroom, will bind and then activate those receptors, the muscarinic receptors all over the body. Okay. So what do we call that? That would be an antagonist to that particular neurotransmitter. Muscarin would be an antagonist because it poisons the system. It poisons those neurons.
Dr. Lee,
yeah. When we get into the cardiovascular chapter, we're still learning a lot about alpha 2 receptors. They're located in the brain, and so the brain is sensitive to levels of epinephrine and norepinephrine. And in a lot of cases, it's inhibitory, and in some cases, they're excitatory. They're the kind of receptor that's used by a very powerful drug called clonidine, which can decrease somebody's blood pressure in just a matter of minutes. All right, so we don't really talk very much about the alpha 2 type receptors in this class. Okay. So acetylcholine is used at all motor neuron synapses at the neuromuscular junction in skeletal muscle, and so that's going to be a nicotinic receptor, so it's always excitatory. All preganglionic receptors are nicotinic, so that will always be excitatory for both the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. And also acetylcholine is used at the parasympathetic postganglionic neurons as well. But now these are not nicotinic type receptors, these are going to be muscarinic receptors. And the two kinds of cholinergic receptors, you have nicotinic, they're blocked by a chemical called curare, right? And muscarinic is a second kind, major class of cholinergic receptors. It's stimulated by muscarin, it's a poison from mushrooms, and it's blocked by atropine, okay? Curare is kind of interesting because there was Aboriginal people in South America that knew something about curare. If you could inject a little bit of curare into a big game animal, then these nicotinic receptors would be blocked, okay? And where do we have nicotinic receptors once again? Neuromuscular junction, right? So the neuromuscular junction can be poisoned so that an animal won't have voluntary control over their skeletal muscle. So with a little tiny arrow that's covered with curare, right, that was shot into an animal, that would then poison the neuromuscular junctions of that animal, and they couldn't run away, and as a matter of fact, they can't breathe either because the diaphragm is a voluntary muscle. So it's a very effective way of hunting large game. But you couldn't let your kids play with it. Very dangerous substance to mess around with. Okay, so here are the two kinds of classes of cholinergic receptors. We got nicotinic on the left, we got muscarinic on the right, And remember that a nicotinic receptor is just a protein in the membrane. When it binds two acetylcholines in the active site right here, it causes a conformation change in this channel so that it opens up. The predominant effect is sodium rushing into the cell, which is, well, how do you think of sodium rushing in the cell? It depolarizes the cell, brings it closer to threshold. That is typically what we understand is what? Excitation. That's not inhibition, but that's excitation. Muscarinic receptors, on the other hand, are all G-protein coupled receptors. And depending on the particular scheme in a particular cell, sometimes it can produce inhibition. For instance, if this activated G-protein, when it dissociates, right, it bumps into a potassium channel and opens it up. And when potassium leaves the cell, that causes what? Hyperpolarization. The membrane potential moves farther away from threshold, right? And that causes inhibition. And for example, in the heart, that will slow the heart rate down because the heart is becoming inhibited, right? In the other case, right, when the G protein becomes activated after the receptor binds an acetylcholine, right, these subunits can bump into a potassium channel, and maybe there's a potassium channel that is normally open, which causes hyperpolarization, but when it closes, it no longer causes hyperpolarization, it causes depolarization. And what do you know about depolarization? It is excitatory on the cell because it causes the cell membrane potential to move closer to threshold. Or, for instance, instead of closing a potassium channel, maybe this activated G protein can open up a sodium or calcium channel. And in either case, if sodium or, where's sodium at a high concentration? Outside the cell, so it's going to want to rush in because the cell is negative as well. What about calcium? Where's calcium at a high concentration? Outside the cell, like sodium, it's even, the gradient is even much higher for calcium. So if this is a sodium or a calcium channel, either of these cause depolarization because what can you tell me about these ions right here? They're both cations, right? So they cause depolarization, which is an excitatory event. Okay, so that causes smooth muscle fibers of the digestive system to contract. So the parasympathetic nervous system is excitatory on the digestive system. And what can you tell me about the way that you should think about the parasympathetic nervous system? You said sympathetic is fight or flight, but what about parasympathetic? Rest and digest, and here now you see a nice mechanism that shows that this does, that parasympathetic stimulation does excite the digestive system. It increases secretions as well as peristalsis of the digestive system. Okay, so that's why we had you guys memorize something about G-protein coupled receptors a while back. Okay, and in each of these cases right here, these are nice ionotropic kinds of receptors. They just change the membrane potential inside the cell by opening ion channels. All right, so here is a table. I don't want you to spend too much time looking at, but it just kind of shows you the two major classes of cholinergic receptors, right? There are nicotinic and there are muscarinic. There's basically, at least for this class, there's one kind of nicotinic receptor, and in every case, acetylcholine opens a cation channel, and when a cation channel opens up, for instance, for sodium and calcium, what happens to the cell? Causes depolarization, which is excitatory, right? So that's always the case for skeletal muscle and autonomic ganglia. And as you could probably have guessed, there are subclasses of muscarinic receptors. All right, and some of these classes work through opening calcium channels, and others work through opening or closing potassium channels, and so that's how they're given different designations. All right, but I don't think I'm going to ask you if the heart has M2. Oh, you know what? There maybe is one or two questions online questions that might ask you for an M2 or an M3, but I won't ask you from the standpoint of lecture or the PowerPoint slides. But there's a question at the end of the chapter or an online question, then I would want you to say, oh yeah, the heart has M2 class muscarinic receptors. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. If it's an online question in the study guide, then yeah, don't ignore those. It's an online question, yeah. Okay. All right, so what are the two main classes of adrenergic receptors? Two main classes of adrenergic receptors. Yeah, alpha and beta. And then you should know some subclasses of those two, like the alpha 1 and then beta 1, beta 2. That's not too bad. And those are extremely important to know clinically. So even after the test, don't forget those. Because if you do, you have to go back and relearn it anyway. Okay, but at least it will be easier the second time around. All right, so that's it for autonomic nervous system. Any more kinds of questions? No? Okay, let me see if I can figure out how to put this thing away. Nice.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
So what's the difference between a paraprocerebral ganglion and a collateral ganglion?
Okay, say that one more time.
What's the difference between a paraprocerebral ganglion and a collateral?
Okay. So whenever you say ganglion, I'm thinking, well, that could be a ganglion, like dorsal root ganglion on the sensory system, bringing information into the central nervous system, into the spinal cord, or it could be a part of the autonomic nervous system, right? Because ganglions are between the preganglionic fiber and postganglionic fiber, and then when you reread the question, then I remember that you're talking specifically about the sympathetic nervous system, okay, in particular. So I think I have a pretty nice picture of that. What chapter was autonomic? Number 9? No, 11? No. 9. Okay. Good. Let's look at this figure right here. Okay. And let me blow it up just a little bit bigger so we can see it a little bit bigger. All right, so here are ganglia, right? That's where the preganglionic axon terminates, and the postganglionic, here's the cell body of the postganglionic fiber, and a ganglion is what? Just a group of these, come on back, a group of these nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system someplace. That's the definition of a ganglion, where you have hundreds or thousands of these. Let me get my pointer back behaving a little bit better. Okay, so we have hundreds or thousands of these nerve cell bodies of the postganglionic fiber someplace as a group in your body. Okay, and both the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system has these ganglia all over the place. The only exception would be what? The preganglionic fiber that goes to the adrenal medulla. Adrenal medulla is acting like a ganglia. All right, so for the sympathetic nervous system, okay, we have the sympathetic chain ganglia right here. See all these little bulges? Well, there's going to be one on the right side of the spinal cord. There's going to be one on the left side of the spinal cord. They're on either side, so they're called the paravertebral ganglia. Sympathetic chain ganglia and paravertebral, meaning on either side, are exactly the same thing. And sometimes the preganglionic fibers move in. They can arise or descend through the sympathetic chain ganglia because the ganglia are connected to each other. Or maybe they can pass right through. Or maybe they stop and synapse right in that ganglia, and here's the postganglionic fiber coming out. So this right here in your notes may be labeled sympathetic chain ganglia or paravertebral ganglia. They're like auxiliary spinal cords for what kind of nervous system? The sympathetic. It's purely sympathetic activity in the sympathetic chain ganglia. Now, if a preganglionic fiber just passes right through the sympathetic chain, it's still going to require a postganglionic fiber to get to the effector organ, because that's how the autonomic nervous system is arranged. And so here is another little ganglia someplace. This is not a paravertebral ganglia because it's not on either side of the spinal cord. Usually they're located anterior to the vertebral column. And so these are called the prevertebral ganglia because they're anterior to the vertebral column. That's not diagrammed on this slide very well, but they're going to be located anterior to the vertebral column. So these are called the the prevertebral or collateral ganglia. So collateral ganglia and prevertebral are the same. I think maybe I did have a slide that maybe shows the prevertebrals a little bit. Right here. Here I can see the sympathetic chain, but if a sympathetic nerve passes right through, Right, so here is a prevertebral ganglia because it is what anterior to the vertebral column. And then there's going to be a synapse right here, and that's just going to be a typical. So here's a cholinergic fiber, and then an adrenergic fiber will come out of this ganglion right here. Okay. So some of these ganglia do run around with different names. Okay, so let me put this guy aside. So this was... So now we're going to move on to a pretty cool chapter, and the labs are pretty cool for sensory system as well. And I think that's chapter 10, right here. Yeah, sensory physiology. All right, so let's talk about receptors. And probably have a little bit of introduction to this already. Sometimes lab instructors will go over some of these things. And lab... If an instructor doesn't go over some anatomy that you should know from Bio 231, then you guys should spend some time in lab and go over the anatomy of the eye. Make sure you know the layers, for instance, and different muscles and things like that, because sometimes we don't have time in lecture to talk about that. All right, so a sensory receptor is something that you have to have in order to... for your body to become aware of certain kinds of energies that are in your environment. Yeah. Yeah, let's get a sign-in sheet going again. Who's got a sign-in sheet? Somebody have a blank piece of paper? Okay, we'll get that. Yeah, it's always good for me to know who's in class, who's not in class. Okay, so what can you tell me about the amount of energy in the universe? Is it changing? Aha, I heard yes and no, and the answer I like is no. The total amount of energy in the universe, at least with our current understanding, is that it is not changing. But what can you tell me about energy? It can be interconverted from one form to another. For instance, light energy can be converted into chemical energy, and that chemical energy can be converted into electrical energy, and vice versa. And that process of converting energy from one form to another is transduction. Okay, so for instance, to transduce something is to change energy that's in the environment into a signal inside your body that your brain can make sense of. And what's the language of a neuron and the language of your brain, because it's made of neurons? Okay, it's electrical. Okay, well, what special kind of electrical event? We dissected that electrical event a lot in this class. Okay, sometimes the membrane potential depolarizes and we know why, and then it repolarizes and hyperpolarizes and we know why. So what do we call that when the membrane potential is not stable but it's changing rapidly? What do we call that? Action potential. That's an action potential. So the language of the nervous system is what? Action potentials. And what can you tell me about an action potential? Why could that be used as a language? It's not very intuitive until you know the secret code. Okay, yeah, it's a signal, but what can you tell me about one action potential compared to another one anywhere in your body? They're exactly the same. So how can it be used as communication if it's always the same? It's the frequency of action potentials that has meaning, right? And then what part of the brain it goes to will determine perception. So for instance, maybe you learned this from anatomy. If action potentials go to the occipital lobe, what are you going to perceive that signal as? Okay, that's your visual lobe, right? You perceive hearing in the temporal lobe. So depending on where those action potentials go, then you'll have the reality of that particular energy in the environment. Okay, and as the frequency of action potentials increases, then the intensity of that stimulus that you're perceiving will increase. Okay, so action potential is the common language of the nervous system, right? And and each kind of nerve responds to a particular modality of energy. Like it could be sound energy, which is pressure, light, which is electromagnetic, or pressure on your fingertips or on the surface of your body. All right, so different modalities perceived as different because of the CNS regions that they stimulate, different lobes of the brain, for instance. So that even if we were to take an electrode and electrically stimulate your occipital lobe, what would be your perception? You might, you would see some kind of visual stimulus, right? You'd have some kind of visual experience, and it probably wouldn't make a whole lot of sense, but you would see something. Okay, so sensory receptors are things that transduce energy in the environment and convert it into action potentials. They can be real simple dendritic endings of neurons, and I see some here on this slide. Come on, cursor. I see some right here. Here are some dendritic endings wrapped around this hair follicle so that when this hair follicle is moved, it causes depolarizations in this neuron, and then you have the sensation that somebody is brushing up against your skin. There are other kinds of free nerve endings in different parts of the body, like over here, and these could be due to pain endings, or just free nerve endings like that. So if there's damage to the tissue, they will send action potentials to the brain. And also temperature. There are cold and hot free nerve endings that send temperature information to the brain. All right, so those are free nerve endings. Or they could be very specialized kinds of nerve endings. Right here, like this Pacinian corpuscle that kind of looks like an onion. So this is a nerve ending that's encapsulated in other tissue. And when there's deformation of these different layers of a Pacinian corpuscle, then it causes action potentials in this nerve fiber. I think I'm going to try a piece of paper to move my mouse around on. Maybe that will work. Let's try check that out. Okay, and Pacinian corpuscles, only slightly better. These Pacinian corpuscles are way down in the dermis, the lowest layers of the dermis, like the reticular layer or down in the hypodermis, so they respond to deep pressure, right? You have others like the Meissner corpuscles that are right at the junction between the epidermis and dermis, and these are responsible for light pressure. And as a matter of fact, there are people that can read with these things. What do they read? Braille, like dimples on a piece of paper, okay? And Ruffini's end organs right here are also for vibration and deeper pressure as well. So depending on the nerve and the kind of receptor organ, then it's responsible for different kinds of stimuli. All right, we can group different receptors depending on the stimulus that they're sensitive to. So chemoreceptors are sensitive to, concentrations of various chemicals inside your body. Like what would be a good chemical to measure inside your body that you should have a chemoreceptor for? What kind of chemicals should you have in your body? Like ATP? Yeah, ATP works directly allosterically with a number of enzyme systems. So enzymes have a binding site or receptor site to ATP. All right, so that's pretty good. Okay, but I'm thinking of, for instance, maybe like a glucose receptor in the pancreas, CO2 receptors, oxygen receptors. What about pH, hydrogen ions? It's a good idea to be able to adjust your body's pH, right? Those are all done by chemoreceptors. Where do you have photoreceptors? In your eyes, in your retina. Okay, thermoreceptors pretty much all over the body. They respond to temperature, changes in temperature. You also have not only thermoreceptors in the skin, but you have central thermoreceptors. And when we say a central thermoreceptor, what should you be thinking of? Central, you should be thinking of central nervous system, and in particular the brain. Okay, so the hypothalamus has temperature receptors, which then, and that's good for monitoring your core body temperature. So anytime we hear central, you should think of central nervous system. Okay, mechanoreceptors, we just talked about, like Pacinian corpuscles. Nociceptors respond to painful stimulus or damaging stimulus to your body. And proprioceptors, right, signal the position of different body parts. These are like tension receptors and pressure receptors within muscles and also within joints so that you have proper control of your body. Okay. We can break receptors down into two main categories. General, right? Or sometimes we call these cutaneous, but a general sense is a sense that you have all over your body. So for instance, if I take an ice cube and put it on your earlobe, can you tell that there's something cold on your earlobe? Yeah. What about your belly button? What about your kneecap? All right. Or top of your head. So where do you have temperature receptors? All over your body. Since you have them all over your body, we call that a general sensation. And what are some other general sensations? If I take a pin, poke your elbow, can you feel that? Yeah. What about your nose? Feel that? So pain is a general sense as well. You have receptors to that all over your body. And vibration, the same thing. So general sensation responds to touch, pressure, temperature, or pain. But we also have some special senses as well. So I want you to appreciate the difference between general and special. Right? And a special sense is when you can appreciate a certain modality of energy in one or two locations in your body. Okay? And it means that you have some some very nicely complicated and delicate kinds of cells that have receptors for that energy. So for instance, if I have a flashlight and hold it up against your belly button, can you see it? Ice cube, you can feel. Light, you can't, right? Or your kneecap, you can't see it. Where can you tell if I have the flashlight on? Only your eyes, right? So that's what we call a special sense, because it's only in those two locations that you can perceive that modality of energy. Okay? So the same thing for hearing. Right? If I put a loudspeaker on the back of your knee, can you hear what's going on in that headset? No. Only if it's over your ears, right? Or if I take some perfume, a perfume bottle, and put it on your big toe and hold the perfume bottle on your big toe, can you feel it? Can you smell it? Or your fingertips, can you smell it? No, only if that chemical gets into your nose. So let's see, what are the special senses? You have vision, you have olfaction. What's olfaction? Smell, okay, because you can only smell with your nose, all right, and hearing is your ear. All right, what else we got? Oh, taste, that's right. If we take some salt and put it on your fingertip, can you taste salt? No, it has to be on your tongue. All right, and then there are two others that have to do with the sense of equilibrium or balance, and these are inside your ear with your hearing apparatus. And so you have five senses that are special. You've got vision, hearing, olfaction, smell, taste, which is the gustatory sense, okay, and then two senses for equilibrium that we're going to look at in this particular chapter. All the rest are what we call general. Now, here's a pretty good quiz. What about proprioception? Is that a special or a general sense? Proprioception.
General.
Yeah, it's really tricky. It is a general sense. And the reason it sounds special, proprioception, but it is general because you have proprioceptors where? Every single muscle, all your joints, they're all over your body, so that's a general sense. Okay. Huh? So you know where your hand is. That's right. I could walk up to a student and say, close your eyes, take their arm, put their hand over their head, and they say, well, my hand's over my head. I know where it is, even with my eyes closed. Or put it behind your back, you know exactly where it is, because you have proprioceptors all over your body. Okay. So another way of understanding something about receptors is that some are tonic and some are phasic. And so what's the job of a receptor again? It's to change some kind of energy in the environment or maybe inside your body into what? Into action potentials, right? So they're transducers. Tonic receptors respond at a constant rate as long as the stimulus is applied. So you don't habituate that sensation. A good example would be pain. So if we apply the stimulus, we see in figure A right here, if we apply a stimulus and keep it on during this whole period of time at the same intensity, notice that these action potentials, what can you tell me about the frequency of action potentials during this period of time right here where the stimulus is applied? It's constant. The frequency is not changing, right? So these are what we call slow adapting or non-adapting or tonic receptors, right? There are other kinds of receptors. When we apply the stimulus, they respond with a very rapid frequency, but if we keep the stimulus applied at the constant rate, then the frequency of these action potentials decreases, and then you habituate that particular kind of stimulus. You become unaware of it. And some of these, we call that adaptation, okay? And a good example would be touch, and smell. Like right now, you probably don't feel that you're wearing any clothes because these are basic kinds of receptors. When you first put on gloves or a hat or your clothes in the morning, you feel getting dressed, but after you wear these clothes for a certain period of time, you no longer have that sensation. Just be a distraction, right? And it's not life-threatening. It's not damaging to your body. Yeah. You're doing what with your hand?
No, when you have a hat.
Oh, you have a hat.
And then you take it off, you still have that feeling like the one you're
looking. I'm not sure what's going on with that hat, causing a sensation that you're feeling something right there. Okay, so, but it's still, it's short-lived though, right? I mean, a day later you don't feel like you're wearing a hat. It's only when you take it off for a short period of time, is what I'm thinking.
3 hours?
Okay, that would be pretty extreme, okay, I think. Maybe if it was on really, really tight, and that might just be because that part of the body was compressed, and after you take the hat off, it just takes a little while for blood to get back into that area to expand that region of your body. That's maybe how I would kind of explain that one, okay? Okay, another good example would be smell, you know. Just about every library I walked into kind of smells like a library. It's not bad, it just has a characteristic smell, right? So when you walk in a library, you go, oh, for sure I'm in the library. We could blindfold everybody and I could walk you into different buildings. I'm sure you could tell me which one is the library. But after you've been in there for an hour, you smell the library smell anymore. You know, all the paper smell is just kind of habituated, right? You have adapted to that circumstance. All right, so this might be an exam figure right here. So don't forget that some receptors are tonic. They don't adapt to the stimulus, and other receptors are phasic, which means that there is an increase in action potentials whenever the stimulus is turned on. And then conversely also, which isn't shown on this diagram, when the stimulus is turned off, right, they might respond with a burst of action potentials again. Okay? Okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. Then it's not an exam. Then it's not an exam figure, though. But you should know the difference between tonic and phasic receptors.
And I was just thinking it's similar to one from the last exam.
Ah, okay. It is very similar. That shows frequency coding. Okay. Okay. And phasic receptors show what? Adaptation. A decrease in the production of action potentials, even though the stimulus is constant. Okay. Fast adapting. Yeah. Are all, no. Like, for instance, light is not. Hearing partly is, but there are some muscles in the middle ear that kind of make it seem like your hearing is adapting. So, no. You have to consider each one of those in its own particular case. Okay. Law of specific nerve energies. Okay, stimulation of a sensory fiber evokes only the sensation of that modality because those action potentials go to that part of the brain that's responsible for perception of that particular modality. All right, there's something called an adequate stimulus. This is the normal stimulus that a receptor responds to. And a receptor, then, if it's given an adequate stimulus, requires the least amount of energy to activate. So for instance, how about with your eyes closed, and maybe you're walking around the house at night and somebody left the door half open or something, all of a sudden you hit your head on the door, and it's totally dark in the house. Now, what happens? What do you see? Well, you see stars. You see little flashes of light, right? So those receptors in your eye can respond to pressure, but it's really not an adequate stimulus, right? It has to be a really strong pressure, or if you hit your eye somehow, it can depolarize different parts of the retina, all right? But that pressure is not an adequate stimulus. The adequate stimulus for the retina is light, right? So that's going to require the least amount of energy because the eye is designed to perceive light and not pressure. All right, so Here are a number of different receptors and what their normal stimulus is. And an adequate stimulus is what? These are the least amount of energies that can properly stimulate these different receptors into sending action potentials to the brain. Like mechanoreceptors for mechanical force, you wouldn't want to use your eyeball for that. But can an eyeball respond to mechanical force? Yes, it can, but it's not designed to do that. Okay. Tissue damage for pain receptors, chemicals in solution for chemoreceptors, and of course light for photoreceptors. Okay, so how do things get started? Well, we have to have a neuron, and a neuron has to be excited. That means it's got to receive a graded potential that reaches threshold. So it's the job of a receptor to generate, right, these depolarizations. And they're equivalent to excitatory postsynaptic potentials. And we can see that stimulus number one is sub-threshold, stimulus number two is sub-threshold, and then stimulus number three is a threshold stimulus, and then that's going to cause an action potential on a neuron, which then that action potential travels into the brain and into that particular area of the brain for that particular modality. Okay. And where does an action potential start on a neuron again? The axon hillock, right, or that initial segment of the axon. Okay, generator potentials are proportional to stimulus intensity. After a threshold is reached, an action potential frequency is proportional to the amplitude of the generator potential. Let me look at the next slide to see if there's something. Yeah, that shows that. So here we have three different generator potentials. Here is a sub-threshold. It doesn't cause any action potentials, right? So here is the stimulus level that produces this generator potential by the receptor. And if this is the case right here, for instance, if that was a visual system right there, what would your perception of light be for stimulus number one? Nothing. It would be dark, right? Completely dark. Okay, but if the light intensity increases, we turn the light on a little bit higher. Here's the generator potential that's produced, and we see that it's threshold. So in the axon going to the brain, what's going to develop? Action potentials, but since this is just barely threshold, the frequency of action potentials will be relatively slow. Okay? And how would you explain this large distance between action potentials with this barely threshold stimulus right here? What's happening? What's preventing many action potentials from being sent to the brain? Which you can't really see on this diagram because I just see a blip right here and a blip. But what's following this blip? There's an area of relative refractory period, right? Hyperpolarization that can't be overcome by this level of stimulation, right? It's not until that hyperpolarization disappears that this becomes a threshold stimulus once again, all right? So the frequency of action potentials is very slow. But if the generator potential is way above threshold, then this amount of excitation or depolarization in the cell can overcome that area of hyperpolarization, and the next action potential can come much sooner in time. So the frequency of action potentials increases. Right, so this would signal an increased intensity or a high intensity of the stimulus to the brain, a high frequency. A low frequency would signal what? A low intensity of stimulus to the brain. All right, let's look at some special senses. Taste and smell. Receptors are exteroreceptors because they respond to chemicals in the external environment. Internal receptors are receptors inside your body that respond to chemicals inside you. For instance, maybe glucose or hydrogen ions or carbon dioxide or even oxygen. All right, so the sense of taste is what we call gustation. And we can sense different tastes because we have taste buds on our tongue. And here is a typical taste bud right here, and when we look at this taste bud, what do you see? What's the component of this taste bud right here? Like I see something right here. Oh, and I see a nucleus. So what are all these little structures right here? These are cells. So in order to see a cell, can you just stick your tongue out in the mirror and look? What do you need to see a cell? You need a microscope, right? So to see a taste bud, you actually need to use a microscope. It's not something that you can see with your naked eye, but when you do stick your tongue out and say, ah, in a mirror, you do see things that kind of stick off your tongue. What the heck are those things? Are those taste buds?
No,
those are called papillae, right? Those are called papillae, and lining all these different papillae, right, are these taste buds. So papillae can have, I don't know, thousands of taste buds on them, right? And so here are all the different cells. And of course you have saliva on the surface of your tongue, and here is a taste pore that allows chemicals to enter the taste bud. And the apical surface right here of the cells of the taste bud, right, are ciliated, and so we call these taste hairs. They're not really hairs, but they're just microscopic cilia. And then there can be different receptors for different chemical compounds that bind to the receptors on these taste hairs right here. So here you have a taste cell, and then you have support cells that nourish and regulate the activity of the gustatory cells themselves. And maybe some of these, under certain circumstances, can be stem cells. They can replace taste cells that become damaged, which is sort of interesting. So here you have the basic five senses for taste. You got sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. And umami is the sense of deliciousness or fulfillment when you eat something, right? And that's due to different amino acids, like glutamate, for instance. Right, taste receptor cells are modified epithelial cells, and there are about 100 in each taste bud, and each taste bud, the structure right here, can respond to all of these different categories of taste. Although on certain parts of the tongue, you might have more sweet taste receptor cells compared to sour or bitter, but that's always in a lot of debate within the community if that's really true or not. Probably has a lot to do with culture as well and how you're brought up as to what kind of tastes you can appreciate and what kind of tastes you can't. So when you eat something, right, it's broken down into these five different categories, and then in your brain, depending on the percentage of each of these things right here, then you'll have the perception of whatever it is that you're eating. Like, what kind of substance have you eaten or drunk that has many of these different kinds of tastes? Like sweet and sour and bitter all together. And I know you guys like it. Like what? Okay, like a candy, for instance, or lemonade, right? Especially if you sweeten it with some sugar. And you're kind of thinking along the lines I'm thinking, but I'm thinking of like a margarita, okay? That has salty and sweeter, salty and sweet and bitter, right, all together, and these different receptors then send all these complex signals to your brain, and your brain analyzes the proportion of them, and you go, oh, well, that's a margarita, and maybe a particular kind of tequila from some in particular place, right, you can analyze. Okay, so let's take a look at what some of these receptors actually look like. All right, well, salty reception is pretty easy. So here is a salt taste cell, and these just have sodium channels that are open all the time, so that when you eat something salty, which is what? Sodium chloride, you have a really high concentration of salt and saliva, and what does it do? It enters through this sodium channel that's open all the time, and when it does, what happens to the membrane potential of this cell? It depolarizes, and what do we call that? Excitation, right? So this cell becomes excited. Here's the taste cell. Here are the hairs or the cilia on them, all right? And that depolarization causes opening of calcium channels in the taste bud. And of course, calcium is high outside the cell. Calcium then enters the cell, and that's just a typical scheme that we know that causes the fusion and docking of neurotransmitters to the cell membrane, releases neurotransmitter, which excites the sensory neuron, and action potentials then move into the brain. All right, so that's pretty easy to see how salty works, because sodium is like the basic compound in table salt. Okay, the same thing for sour. Sour is, the perception of sour is the result of acids that we have in our food. And what's the chemical compound that makes something acidic? Hydrogen ions or protons, right? So if we eat something like vinegar, which is acetic acid, there's a high concentration of hydrogen ions, and it moves through this particular channel right here, which is a cation channel particular for hydrogen ions. And when a hydrogen ion enters a cell, what happens to the membrane potential of the cell? It depolarizes, which is what, an excitatory event. And again, that causes opening of these calcium channels, which then causes the fusion and docking of these synaptic vesicles that release neurotransmitter, which then sends action potentials to the brain. Okay, and then so you have a particular part of the brain that is sensitive to these action potentials. You'll have the perception of salt. You have another region in the brain when it receives action potentials gives you the perception of sour. Okay, so that's the first two kinds of receptors. Sweet and umami bind to receptors on the membrane, and look what they work through. G-protein coupled receptors, which then cause the development of second messengers. Could you maybe give me some examples of second messengers? Maybe cyclic AMP or calcium, for instance. We're going to learn a couple more later on in the class. They build up inside this taste receptor cell, and that closes, this second messenger then closes potassium channels. All right, so this is for sweet and umami, like sweet from sugars that are in our food. And if you close the potassium channel, well, how does that affect the membrane potential? Okay, I tell you what, if this potassium channel is open, what happens to the cell? This is what you're most familiar with. If a potassium channel is open, it causes repolarization or hyperpolarization, which is what? Inhibitory on a cell, that's inhibitory. But if we close a potassium channel, don't allow potassium to leak out, then that causes the opposite, depolarization, which is excitatory, which then causes release of neurotransmitter right here. So that's for sweet and umami working through this G-protein coupled receptor. And the same thing for bitter. A good example of something bitter is quinine that you have in what, like tonic water, if you want to perceive what that is like. So quinine binds to this receptor, causes the buildup of a second messenger, and it causes calcium release from endoplasmic reticulum. Endoplasmic reticulum, if it's smooth, typically it's a smooth kind of endoplasmic reticulum, is a storage place for calcium. So endoplasmic reticulum can pump calcium from the cytosol into that organelle, and then when it's stimulated by the second messenger, calcium flows out of endoplasmic reticulum, and that calcium signal causes the fusion and docking of these synaptic vesicles, which then releases excitatory neurotransmitter on this neuron, and then you have the perception of bitter. All right, so these G-protein coupled receptors are very common, and they're the most highly conserved kind of receptor system anywhere in nature. That means basically all organisms have these kinds of signal transduction schemes in their cells. All right, so what sense is that? Gustation, which is the sense of taste. So these molecules actually have to bind to receptors that are in that taste bud. All right, sense of smell, which is olfaction, of course, happens in your nose. All right, so here we see the nasal cavity with a couple nasal conchae right here. Here's the olfactory tract and the olfactory bulb, and then there are olfactory nerves that can actually move through this bone that helps make up the cranial vault. Can anybody remember what bone this is right here? Pretty close to sphenoid. Sphenoid is a little bit posterior. It's a little bit back over here. Here's the frontal bone. Here's the frontal paranasal sinus. So what's between the frontal bone and the sphenoid? That's the ethmoid bone, okay? So, and here's that bony plate, and that's called the cribriform plate, and then I see a bunch of foramina, right, in the cribriform plate of, oh, right here it says ethmoid bone. So what are all these foramina called? Olfactory foramina, because the olfactory nerves, right, move from the nasal cavity up into the central nervous system right here. And I think we learned some neurons by their shape. We classified neurons by their shape. And here is a, what's the shape of this neuron right here? This is a bipolar neuron, and we said bipolar neurons are used in special senses, and olfaction is a special sense because you can only smell with your nose. And I can see some cilia again. These cilia have receptors for odorant molecules that enter the nasal cavity. And for instance, if you really want to smell something and really analyze the smell of something, what do you have to do? Can you just very gently smell something, or what do you usually do? You sniff, you go, and why is that? Because you need those odorant molecules way up over here in the superior part of the nasal cavity to bind with these receptors, right? So in order to smell something, you really have to get those odorant molecules up here to bind with these receptors, and that causes action potentials that go through the cribriform plate into the olfactory bulb, where you have the secondary cell. So here's a synapse. So these things right here are what we call glomeruli, and there's some signal processing taking place. Now, for gustation, there are five senses, and for the sense of smell, there are thousands of different kinds of receptors, and they all interact within the olfactory bulb so that you have even more precise sense with smell compared to gustation. Now, the funny thing about these receptor cells right here, right, these neurons, okay, look at these cilia. They're actually outside your body. This is the only place that I'm aware of where you actually have parts of neurons that are dangling outside your body. Most are inside your body. All right, so what can you tell me about the environment that this cell is living in? It's really harsh. Anything that you breathe into your body, these cells are subjected to. So these neurons are very short-lived because they have a really hard life, which is okay because some of these epithelial cells right here, I can't see, they pretty much all look like the same color. These all look like bipolar cells. All right, some of these cells are stem cells. And what can a stem cell do? It can differentiate and replace these olfactory cells right here that die because it's in a really rough environment. So that's pretty interesting. Here we have neurons, right, that can actually differentiate, and stem cells that can differentiate to become neurons. Now, why is that sort of interesting? Because some parts of your body, right, when a neuron is damaged, it can't regenerate. But what are these right here in your nose? What do these do all the time? Every couple weeks, right? Or maybe every couple months, they regenerate. So maybe sometime, if somebody has a spinal cord injury, we can harvest some of these cells from somebody's nose, transplant them to the spinal cord, and maybe a spinal cord can regenerate. Would that be fascinating to get motion back?
There's a pulsator doing that.
Who's doing that?
A pulsator, I think it's...
Oh, they're trying to regenerate a spinal cord by doing some kind of transplant therapy?
Yeah, but
Oh, because it's not approved in the United States. This is true, because we have very stringent control over practices, right, until we really know that they're going to help somebody. All right, so you got receptor cells, you got the support cells, and the basal cells are the stem cells that can replace. Now, the other interesting question may be rattling around in your mind, if we use these basal cells, all right, to regenerate somebody's spinal cord, what might be the capability of somebody's spinal cord? Maybe you can smell with your spinal cord. That would be interesting. Okay. Yeah. But probably not, because those action potentials, in order for you to perceive smell, not only do you have to have receptors, these action potentials have to go to the right part of the brain to have that perception as well. So that's probably not a really important factor. The support cells are important because they contain detoxifying enzymes that help protect the epithelium and the bipolar cells, because remember, anything that's in the air is affecting these cells, including any kind of toxins as well. All right, and I think this is where we're going to finish up. Odor molecules bind to receptors. They all act through G proteins, and there are thousands of different kinds of G protein receptor cells. It's not simple like gustation. All right, so next time we're going to start with ears and maybe finish up with vision. All right, so that's it for today. What about nerve regeneration? Yeah, we're learning more and more about stem cells in different parts of the body that can be used, hopefully someday, to regenerate nervous systems. in parts of the nervous system that does not like to regenerate, like central nervous system.